Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Yeah, hello. This is WRCT Pittsburgh, Forbes Avenue. I'm Riona Duncan. I'm interviewing Catherine Evans here today.
Hello.
Hey, so today we're going to be talking about queer archiving, queer history, and feminist in literature and culture in the United States. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited.
Me too. So you're a PhD student in literary and cultural studies here at Carnegie Mellon. How did you end up here studying this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in my fourth year. It's a six-year program. I ended up here because throughout my undergraduate and master's studies, I found myself really interested in intergenerational conversations and specifically working to think through these histories that are often not told whenever it comes to queer life. So specifically, I'm interested in working class queer life and everyday lesbian and feminist life. So after working with some elders in the community, I decided I was super interested in getting a PhD in this, which is a six-year endeavor. So, yeah.
And how did you end up at Carnegie Mellon?
Yeah, so I ended up at CMU. I did my undergraduate at Duquesne University, so I was already in Pittsburgh. And I was particularly interested in continuing to work in Pittsburgh because I'm really interested in Pittsburgh working class lesbian culture and feminist culture. So it was kind of the perfect place to be for this. I'm also interested in cultural studies as a field, which is one of CMU's specialties in the particular program that I'm in. So I'm not just looking at literature, right? The traditional literature such as novels, memoirs, and things like that. But I'm also interested in archival objects like t-shirts, board games, card games. And I wanted a program that would allow me to do that. And that's how I ended up here. And yeah.
All right. Do you have like an all-time favorite piece of media? So like could be a book or TV or a t-shirt or board game.
Yeah. All-time favorite media. That's a really good question. So I think my all-time favorite media that I'm writing about, that'll be my like caveat. I'm working with a collection of t-shirts from activist Kip Dawson, who is a Pittsburgh legend. She was a women's coal miner and then a public school teacher. And she has a t-shirt collection of about 250 shirts. They're currently sitting in my apartment. We're working on archiving them. It's a whole story. But in the collection of t-shirts, there is one shirt that's a hard-hatted woman, and it has a woman with a hard hat on, carrying her gloves and her work stuff. But it's my favorite as like a form of media because Kip wore it into the coal mines when she was working. So there's like dust stains on it and it's really worn. And it's just a really cool piece of media, or I would argue that it's media. I don't know if everyone agrees that t-shirts are media, but that's part of the argument I'm making with it.
Wow, that does sound really cool. How did you end up crossing paths with Kip Dawson?
Yeah, so I ended up meeting Kip in 2021. She was working to start saving and archiving the stuff that she had kept over her lifetime of work. So in addition to being a public school teacher and a coal miner, she's also an activist. She's been involved in basically every major movement you can think of, from civil rights to the anti-war movement. She planned like the second Pride Festival ever in New York City. Yeah, she has like a wild trajectory, but I met an historian who was looking to help her save her materials. And so I started working with her in her house to archive the stuff and put it in actual folders and, you know, put like some order on it. And we got really close through that process. And now her papers are open at the University of Pittsburgh. So you can go request the Kip Dawson papers and you can go see the program for the second ever Pride Festival, or you can see a scrapbook she made and things like that. So yeah, I started working with her through that. And since then we've become collaborators and that's where we're at now.
That's awesome. Is that how you got into archiving queer stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. yeah, so I was interested in archives before that, and I'd done some archival work at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, Schlesinger Library, during my master's studies. And so I'd been on the other side of the archive, like looking through the stuff, writing about the stuff, and I'm still doing that. But I was really interested in how were these things constructed and how are they saved and how are they documented. And so I was basically self-trained through collaborations with the University of Pittsburgh. And it was a little bit of a different process than normal archival work because it's not like a formal degree or anything like that, although there are formal degrees in it. So yeah, that was how I started working with Archives More on the other side, the creation and curation side.
So how does that look like if you're not, you know, going through books and putting them in archive? It's more t-shirts.
Yeah, so it's kind of wild. So Kip's collection has traditional paper materials. Those were a little bit more straightforward, dates, places, things like that. She has her journal entries from like every year of her life, which is truly incredible. You can go to 1985 and look at August 2nd and know exactly what she was doing. So those were more traditional, but things like ephemeral materials like buttons, t-shirts, things like bumper stickers. She has an entire folder of beer cozy, like what are those things called? Coasters.
Yeah.
That she like collected while she was traveling. So those were a little bit harder, and they kind of break out of archival form in some ways. And they're a little bit of a problem because, first of all, textiles, they break down, they kind of fall apart. And so part of what's happening with the t-shirts actually is they're not at the archive yet. They're still sitting in my house and they're still in process. But we're working to digitize them with the University of Pittsburgh. So they'll be available entirely digitally online. And then the shirts that don't get passed down to her family members, those will then go to the University of Pittsburgh. But basically they'll be tagged by the date of origin, if we can find it, the movement or cause that it was associated with, because there's a lot of different causes. And then also the like logo color and things like that. So they'll be searchable and you'll be able to find them through the finding aid. But yeah, and t-shirts, there are a lot of collections that have t-shirts, but 250 t-shirts is just a lot of t-shirts.
Absolutely. So what kind of things would you say you wish were better preserved if we're going beyond, you know, the limits of traditional archiving?
Yeah, that's a great question. So things like, well, things like the t-shirts, these things that are like everyday queer media, that's part of the argument I'm making in my dissertation and something I'm thinking about a lot is what do we do with these everyday objects that are worn and then discarded? And we don't necessarily think of as high media, something like a book, novel, movie again. But I really wish that there were more things like that saved. I also think a lot about events and like these fleeting moments in time. Sometimes we have recordings, which are great, but often we don't. So I'll find myself reading through like ticket stubs and things that are, you know, customarily discarded. And so more of that everyday matter of media, I guess, is what I wish we saved more of. And in an ideal world, I think that I would be able to look at everyone's t-shirts, which maybe is too much to ask, but I do think it could be incredible to think about the ways that we can preserve things and what we can do with that. So yeah, more of that everyday media.
Yeah. I know something else you also look at are board games.
Yes.
So what makes a board game part of the movement as opposed to just like, you know, let's buy it, let's go play?
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, because when I tell people I'm interested in feminist or queer or lesbian board games, they're like, what? That exists? I'm like, yes, it did exist and does exist. But part of what I think is interesting about board games in relationship to like the feminist or lesbian movements are thinking about the role of joy and happiness and just general camaraderie and like how that's built, but also the ways that we build our own knowledge as a movement or as a community. So for instance, some of the board games are trivia games, and the trivia was community curated. So this board game, Do You Know Enough, which is an acronym, but that board game is specifically looking at building lesbian knowledge. And so after curating the community to find like histories of lesbian elders, things in arts and culture, all of these different categories that you normally see in a Trivial Pursuit game, right, they curated it to be for the community and for you to feel more as though you're a part of a community, even if it's not visible. And so part of what's interesting about board games is there's this intimacy of play, right? Like you're playing with people, you're learning more about them. There's this fun laughter, joy that comes out of it that sometimes can make more serious topics approachable, but also can at the same time be an educational tool. So I'm really interested in those games that are in that kind of intersection.
Yeah, that's really cool. I also know you're into drag, which I feel like might have a lot of connections to that.
Yeah.
In terms of joy.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm interested in drag also because of the joy, because of queer joy, because of all the things that go into it. And also I'm interested in drag that's not like Drag Race, which is like maybe a hot take, but not really. I'm working on a book right now called Iconic, Drag Celebrity and Queer Community. And that book is really looking, it's an edited collection, so there's a lot of different scholars in it. But we're looking at drag that's the dirty drag, the drag that isn't necessarily the sanitized queer subject that we see on RuPaul's Drag Race, although we love Lydia.
We do.
Yes, love her. But thinking about that drag that is used in community activism, that drag that's more of an everyday practice, and also those drag histories that haven't been saved. And that's something with, there's a lot of holes in drag archives, right? So we see that's, again, one of those fleeting, ephemeral moments after the performance, what remains. And so we're interested in this thing called drag infrastructures, which is a term, dare I coin a term, but drag infrastructures are thinking about those networks, circuits, and different things that go into tangibly making drag practice possible. So things like the marketing, things like the wigs, things like the bar schedule, the stools, the space itself. And so, yeah, that's, again, falling on that same line of joy, but also looking at the very serious community nature of drag and the everyday drag. So there's a lot of really great stuff that we're thinking about, ranging from people who are using drag for a lot of different causes, whether that be an advocacy cause or something politically, or if it's just building community. And I say just building community, but that's actually the whole point, right, is through joy, play, and all of those things.
All right. So you seem to study a lot of activism. What do you think that people should know more about in terms of activism here in Pittsburgh, either now or in the past, obviously?
So I think that one of the courses I teach is a first year writing 76-106, writing about literature, art, and culture here at CMU. My section's focused on campus activism and the history of campus activism at CMU. And one of the things that I wish that people knew and I think is worth sitting with is the rich history that CMU has and also that the greater Pittsburgh community has in relationship to the feminist movement and specifically in those working class causes. So there's a lot of people who are still alive and still here who made major strides, whether that be in moving towards equal pay, whether that be advocating for different types of rights, from reproductive rights to trans rights to just the ability for lesbian and gay couples to adopt their own children. Like, that stuff has happened here in Pittsburgh. And I wish if I could, like, pinpoint one specific thing. I'm thinking about the history of the CMU Women's Center, which there used to be a women's center on campus. I don't know if this is, like, known knowledge, but there was a women's center, and there were ties to Riot Girl and things like that, which I think is a super, super fascinating history. But to see this group of women coming together to build the space and to advocate for change on campus and beyond, I think is really representative of what is possible within an academic institution and also the greater community and being porous in that way and having that interplay. And I guess the last point with that, too, is there's this really great piece in the archives that the headline of the tartan that year was, "It would never happen here." And it did happen here. And the headline is, like, over top of basically a massive protest on campus. So just remembering that Pittsburgh and CMU is a place where these things have happened and continue to happen again, whether that be the activism that's outright in massive protests or those little acts of everyday resistance.
Do you think there's a reason why it used to happen, and then I feel like I haven't seen any large protests at Carnegie Mellon in the 2 years I've been here, which isn't particularly long, but is a sample size.
Yeah, it is a sample size. Oh, man. There are a lot of reasons, I think. One of the things that I think about a lot is how campus cultures and climates can change and do so rapidly. That happens, the student body's turning over, right, pretty rapidly.
Constantly.
Yeah, constantly. People are graduating, new people are coming in. And although we have like a set tartan identity, that's always evolving, right, from year to year. And I think right now, whenever we're thinking about what activism looks like and what is possible, we're in a very particular political climate and moment. We have things like the expressive policy right now at CMU. There are other types of things that exist. But yeah, so I think that that's part of it. But also I want to say, too, I do think student activism is happening maybe in different forms, right? Mm-hmm. We're in a different media landscape now. There's also, I think, just because we're not always seeing the massive gatherings on campus doesn't mean that students aren't still advocating for change.
And absolutely not.
Yeah, and I think that that's sometimes harder for us to see and to read. And that's part of what I'm interested in my work, and also what I'm interested in the campus activism class is seeing, like, how have students advocated for themselves? How have they came together or not? And what have those moments look like? Not to romanticize them, of course. There's always conflict, but yeah.
Yeah. What would you say is unique about Pittsburgh's working class, especially given that's what you're interested in, lesbian and feminist scene?
So I think part of what makes the Pittsburgh a lesbian and feminist scene unique, I'm particularly interested in the period of the long 70s, which we tend to characterize as like 1969 to like 1998. And so a lot of the women I'm working with are now in their 60s, 70s, some of them are in their 80s. And whenever I'm talking with them about what the scene has looked like, whether that scene be the bar scene or it be more of the like dinner group scene or the potluck scene versus like any of the other scenes, I think that what I find that's unique is their commitment to coalition building and their commitment to ensuring that even though we're located here in Pittsburgh, we're open to the larger movement and larger causes. So a lot of the women talk about their international work. So Pittsburgh being represented in places like El Salvador, in places like Cuba, in places like the UK. And often these movements, these people were there representing things like the United Mine Workers of America or the United Steelworkers. So they were connected to their unions. But they were still representing these unions while being lesbians, while being feminists, while traveling internationally. And to see a lesbian feminist as the face of the United Mine Workers of Pittsburgh in El Salvador, I think is really unique. And I'm not sure if that could happen anywhere else except for here. And I think that's partially because of the union culture and partially because of the working class culture that comes out of it. So that's just one example. And I'm talking about Kip Dawson there and her travel to El Salvador.
So you work on the long 70s. What do you think is some things that, you know, I wasn't alive then. What can we learn from that period? Exactly. What can we learn from that period of time? Why is it important specifically?
Yeah, that's a great question and something I have to justify. But I think that it's an important period of time. And I use that categorization of the long 70s because when I'm looking across these different media, and so particularly in my dissertation, for example, I'm talking about anthologies, then I'm talking about board games, then I'm talking about handbooks, like guides to like how to be a lesbian and things like that. And then I'm coming through and talking about t-shirts and these other media. I'm grouping a lot of media together and across a long range of time. But the long 70s in particular, I think, opens up a way for us to see how media has in some ways stayed the same, but also how it's adapted and how the 70s continues to influence what we're seeing in our media scapes and scenes. So particularly I'm thinking about t-shirts, right? So t-shirts are a relatively new invention, contrary to popular belief. The first like political t-shirt was like Do It for Dewey, which was a presidential run, but that's a whole side note. But whenever we're thinking about the t-shirts as emerging in like working class cultures, they start off because people are refashioning their like undergarments when they're going to work in the coal mines and other places. And then they're like cutting them in half and cutting them into t-shirts. And then we see them become this mass phenomenon. Like we can buy t-shirts just about anywhere today, right? But the t-shirts that I'm looking at are ranging from like the 60s through now. And so looking at those types of media, we can see the 70s, that uptake of printing technology, the uptake of fabric. You can see like how the t-shirts are becoming a little bit more inhabited in a lot of ways. And that's just one example, but I think that it shows us how our media is evolving. I also think it comes back to the political teeth too of the feminist and lesbian causes.
Wow, I thought t-shirts had been around way longer than that.
Well, they've been around like they didn't first come up in like the 60s or 70s, but yeah, they were really being refashioned and they were being mass produced then around World War II, but printing on t-shirts was relatively new.
Wow.
Yeah, fun fact.
The more you know.
The more you know.
So you do a lot of work with trying to archive and bring these stories to the modern day.
Yeah.
What would happen if you weren't there? Would somebody step in the gap or would this be lost?
It's a really good question. I think probably lost. In the case of Kip, she has a community and she has historians working behind her. Dr. Jessie Ramey, who's at Chatham University, is working on her bio right now. She's writing a biography, so I'll just plug that. But I'll also say, I think that part of what has happened is this idea of people always say like certain histories are privileged, right? Like there are histories that rise to the top and there are histories that fall to the bottom. And when we think about working class queer histories, those histories aren't necessarily told, right? And I hate to think what would happen. There are a lot of people doing this work, especially in other contexts, and I am indebted to like generations of scholars that make it so I can do this work. But I think, yeah, I'm not sure what would happen. I know that there's a lot of people who have archives sitting in their homes that they're never going to make it to a place like the University of Pittsburgh or like Carnegie Mellon, but I think they should, and I would love for them to, or for them to be accessible in other ways. So yeah, and I think part of what I've learned through all of this is we all are building archives, whether we realize it or not, which that can be anything from the diary entries we're writing, our social media posts, our papers we're writing in classes, the t-shirts we're wearing, like anything and everything is an archive if there's a story and if you can build that out. That's part of my whole argument. But
so my search history could be an archive?
It could be an archive. I would say it could be. It could be media too. But is it media? Could be.
What are some of the cool things you found? Say Kip Dawson has a lot of historians behind her, but what is some cool things you found from working in the community and on archiving with people who probably do not have all that?
Yeah, so I'm going to give an example that's not necessarily entirely Pittsburgh-based, but I think is a good example. So I was working at the Radcliffe Schlesinger Library at Harvard up at Cambridge. And in that, there's the records from this magazine, or I guess newspaper is a more proper term, Sojourner, which was a really big feminist paper. And they saved all of the letters that they ever got in the mail. And so you can like search through their letters. But a part of this that they have in their records are the letters of incarcerated women who were receiving the paper while they were in prison. And so this was something that when I was reading through those stories, I found myself particularly drawn to the fact that some of these women might not even know that their papers are archived at Harvard, which is kind of wild to think about. And so in reading through some of these, there was one woman in particular who's incarcerated in Pennsylvania, and she's an older lesbian, and she's still incarcerated in Pennsylvania. And in finding her letter, I reached out and was just like, hey, like I found this at Harvard. I just wanted to say, like, thank you for your writing and work. Like, I feel like I've learned a lot from it. And that was one example of how an archive brought me to someone who I otherwise would have never engaged with. I would have never known, but she had been publishing things in the paper. And so, yeah, it was a great conversation. And I was happy to be able to play a little part in like helping this person see where her stuff has ended up, but also in just communicating as humans, right? And building those connections, whether it be across time and space or in different modalities. So that's one example.
Do you have any others, or is that your favorite?
Oh, I have many. That's one. Another one, there's a lot here. there was one example of I was working on a piece thinking about this one very particular publisher, Persephone Press, out of Boston. And in working through that, I ended up finding a snippet for somebody who it turns out was living in Pittsburgh. And so I got to meet her and to hear her accounts of being involved with this. Well, not even involved with the press, but reading the books when they were coming out and being at these events and what it meant for her to move from one space to another. And it was a really interesting intergenerational conversation of like, here I am kind of romanticizing this thing because I've read the books, I've been to the archive, I feel like I'm making this argument and claim. And something that I was reading is very serious. She was like, no, like, this was satire. Like, we were not serious about what we were saying here. Like, that was a joke. And I was like, oh, wow, yes, okay, I need to think critically, but also think a little bit, too, about how our positions impact how we come to the archive, right? We all come to these historical things and documents with certain positions, whether we realize it or not, and we might think that we're being good researchers, but sometimes it just takes talking to somebody who was there or doing an oral history or something along those lines. So talk to your elders.
How do you think your lens as a English and literary and cultural studies person brings to this? Because usually if I was thinking of somebody going through an archive, I would think it would be a historian.
Yeah, definitely. So I work with a lot of historians, and I'm definitely not a historian. Not at all. Not at all. I wish, but I'm not. And so, actually, no, I don't wish. What am I saying? So I think my lens is really interesting because I'm interested in the theoretical. I'm interested in how we can theorize what's going on and how that might help us understand our world. And I think that that changes what I'm interested in, right? So whenever I'm telling the stories I'm telling, I'm often thinking about how that informs a cultural practice. So for instance, with the board games, I'm interested in this cultural practice that comes out of playing the feminist board games or the lesbian board games and how it's building an identity construction or what it's doing there. It's all wrapped up in ideology and all those things. But a historian might be interested in a different side of that, right? And that side is also really important, and I would cite that side. But again, the argument is more theoretical and interested in that construction. I also think I read differently and write differently, just stylistically. Like, there are differences between the fields. I know sometimes at CMU we loop the humanities together, but they are distinct. We do have our own specialties. And I think that influences how I read things too. And I do talk about literature. I know I'm not claiming that drag is literature or t-shirts are literature. I am claiming they're media, but I think that they're wrapped up in each other, and it does influence how I come to things, whether that be theoretically or just in the arguments I'm making.
So you're talking a lot about the different movements and the coalitions that built between them. How did they all come together, or how did they all keep apart? How did that look in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, so Pittsburgh's really interesting, and I could talk about this for a very long time. So what I think is interesting with someone, again, I'm going to go back to Kip, which thinking with Kip and thinking alongside how she was involved in so many major movements, so many people were involved in so many movements, but we often don't hear the stories of those people who were moving across movements. We normally hear, like, the figureheads, right? So, like, we think of feminism. Who do we think of? Like, people come to mind.
Everybody who's on the, you know, the front of it, like Elizabeth Stanton.
Yeah. Like those people, like Gloria Steinem, like those types of figures, especially when we're thinking like second wave feminism. Somebody like Kip doesn't necessarily come up because she's an everyday person, but there were thousands of people involved in feminism and involved in like lesbian and LGBTQ rights, and also thousands of people involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and all of these other movements. And she's an example of just one of all of these people who was never a one-issue feminist, never a one-issue activist. And so what I see in the movements coming together through her is sometimes collision points, right? So sometimes there's tensions that are happening whenever she was first involved in the feminist movement, people didn't want lesbians in the movement. People would like lesbian bait. Like the Lavender Menace was like a whole thing that happened. Yeah. And she tells those stories very well. But I think that one of the things that we can learn through her, and specifically in Pittsburgh, is that there have been moments when people have come together in coalition, whether that be defending public schools or that be moving to increase access to different community resources or things along those lines. We can see how she came together with people whose causes maybe she didn't 100% align with all of the time, but there was still solidarity and coalition work. So that's a little bit of a rambling answer, but an example of just like one person, and there's a lot of people who have those stories, and people might not be always those figureheads or leaders, but I think we have something to learn from them and how they engaged with the movement, whatever that might be.
So we are starting to run a little low on time. So do you have anything you want to say that you haven't said yet? Do you have anything coming up that maybe people should know about?
Yeah, I do actually. Thank you for asking. So in the fall, Chatham University is going to be doing an exhibition of the t-shirt collection, which is very exciting. There's also going to be some events. It's running October 13th, roughly, to like December 12th. So mark your calendars, and the t-shirts will be on display, and they will be engaged with the public. So you can come, anyone can come, everyone should come.
Awesome. Anything else going on?
You can look out for the drag book. It'll be coming out here soon, and hopefully we'll have some drag shows or something fun. So look out for Iconic also.
Absolutely. All right. Well, this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT. I've been Riona Duncan and have had Catherine Evans. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me again. This has been so much fun.
Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.com.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It is a sunny, sunny Thursday, except not exactly that warm, unfortunately. I'd like to welcome you all to The Angry Young Man. Firstly, before we do get into the mix of things, just like to remind you all that everything that is said today by myself and my guest is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members and are strictly those of myself and my guest. Which, let's get right into it with introducing my wonderful guest, a friend of mine. It's going to be Ilyas Khan. How you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I don't know. It's middle of the second semester, so what more can you say?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's got that vibe to it, especially once, you know, it's supposed to be nice and warm now and you're getting February temperatures back.
Oh boy, yep. Yeah. I totally feel it. It was like 70 degrees last week and I was outside tanning and now this week
it was beautiful.
Horrible.
Well, so, you know, for those of you just tuning in, Ilyas, you are a member of the Sunrise Movement in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sunrise?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm actually the hub coordinator of our local Sunrise Movement hub. And what Sunrise Movement essentially is and does is it's a youth-oriented climate justice movement, right? So it's not just an organization, but really it's a concept of how to make change around climate change and climate justice on a local level. And my job, really, with Sunrise Movement is just to make sure that we are engaging with our community and we are, you know, moving apace in terms of making actual direct climate policy change. So that's kind of my position, and you know, over the past 2 years I've been in the position, you know, it's been really wonderful to get to know and really work with Allegheny County communities on issues of climate justice.
So what are some ways that you've kind of practically worked with our communities in Allegheny County and worked to kind of push for change?
Absolutely. So there's been some really wonderful things happening at the county level, particularly recently, but also in the past. A few years ago, we were part of the coalition that managed to pass a ban on fracking in public parks, which apparently you could do until a few years ago. And there were huge risks, kind of, you know, if you've grown up in Southwest PA, you know just how dangerous a lot of the frack gas wells can be, especially for children, right? So to have that, you know, just out in the open where children are playing was a huge risk to public safety, and we managed to put a stop to any future construction of those frack gas wells. And just recently, we were part of the major push to have the new administration draft a climate action plan, really a comprehensive plan to address more than just climate, but also things like housing inequity, flood and emergency services, healthcare, all kinds of stuff, really, that are integral to creating a sustainable Allegheny County in the years to come.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you who have been listening to the show for the past couple weeks, you'll know that we spoke a little bit to this issue of, you know, kind of a localized climate-related or environmental policy-related actions taken, particularly by determining what the particular needs and wants or sacrifices that a community wants to make, depending on their situation. And that's, you know, something that you've kind of very practically dealt with hands-on, and something I did want to kind of drill into a little bit, just because, you know, not, you know, no pun intended on the fracking, but you know, the issue of housing in Allegheny County and Pittsburgh, that's something that I haven't had the opportunity to kind of talk about here and would love to kind of address with you, particularly because there are a couple things at play right now. You know, firstly, With the new administration, like you'd mentioned, there's a policy goal in the area that the Inamorato administration has, particularly something that she had campaigned on, which I find to be particularly concerning, was the housing reassessment that she and her administration is embarking on currently, which many people pointed to during that election season as something which would disproportionately hurt large swaths of the Pittsburgh and Allegheny County communities that would have the assessment of their property put at a higher level, pushing them to pay more in property tax. Particularly something that I would say has the opportunity to, especially if this is something that is being pressed on to people who rent out. You have when someone's renting out to a college student or someone who's in lower income bracket, when they have their property taxes raised, that's something that's going to get passed along in cost in rent. And that's something, you know, obviously we want to avoid that, especially for people who are in less of a position to provide capital upfront for their renting purposes. And to increase that is to push a higher detriment upon them. And that's something that, you know, one thing I was concerned about. And the second thing that I'm not too sure about, if that's something that's being pursued by the administration, but there was a mention during the campaign of a tenant's bill of rights. Which involved within it, to my understanding, the basis for price controls on rent, which I've spoken about before on the show, particularly in the first time around, but also spoke about it a little bit in length on my talk on rent controls in Argentina, kind of talking about the issues that are inherent to price controls and what that ends up passing on to in cost to renters. So I'm curious to get some reflections from you in regards to, you know, someone who's had the opportunity to work on drafting housing-related policy to suggest to the administration in Allegheny County.
Absolutely. So most of the policy that I've engaged with is less directly housing, but it is related through questions of sustainability as well as affordability and equity. As a whole, you know, and I think you bring up a great point that, you know, when we have questions of tax reassessment and redistribution, oftentimes this can end up heavily affecting marginalized communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, but also, you know, more urban communities that depend more heavily on renting. But I think, you know, you brought up the idea of a tenant's bill of rights. You know, on the one hand, right, your fear about the potential for how tenants can be disproportionately impacted by these reassessments is very much valid and justified. And I share it, as a matter of fact. But I think to have a tenant's bill of rights isn't necessarily, you know, pushing us towards an Argentinian model per se, but I think it does open up a lot of avenues for tenants to actually have a greater degree of decision-making power in their own rental situations, and that as well as the insured protections for those tenants, which are, you know, a natural product of that Bill of Rights, would sort of, hopefully, you know, assuming I haven't quite seen a draft of that Bill of Rights, but you know, assuming the All In for Allegheny County survey, which I don't know if you were aware of.
Yes, I haven't had the opportunity to kind of look through it, but I was aware that was circulating at the moment. Yeah,
right. So there are some questions about housing, as I recall. It was a very long survey. Sarah, next time you do that, please give us a heads up about how long it's going to be. I think to have a Bill of Rights might help alleviate some of that potential stress, because it would put renters in greater control of that whole dynamic, and allow for more negotiation between tenants and their landlords.
Well, I too am not very familiar with a lot of the things that were proposed in it. Just one thing that stood out to me during that process was the prospect of potential rent control in Allegheny County. And that, you know, the reason I bring up Argentina is because nationally in 2020 there was an ordinance passed for the institution of rent controls in Argentina. And, you know, rent controls are one primary thing, but even looking at other potential regulation regarding the relationship between tenant and landlord, when you impose, firstly, rent controls on a landlord, you know, this is your ceiling for charging rent. At a certain point, it becomes more profitable for these landlords to sell the properties than to further provide housing as an opportunity, which contracts the supply of available rental housing. And that's a primary concern there, but also at the same time, what you saw in Argentina was a lot of the times landlords would forego very expensive repair or maintenance on the property just because of the other absorbed cost that would come by having a much higher overhead compared to now a restricted rent, which in many cases, hopefully this would not be the case in Allegheny County, but specifically in a high inflation economy, is not very adaptable to the needs of suppliers in that case. So that's kind of one thing there, but also just in terms of other kind of like more abstract non-economic regulation, you know, just the attractiveness of providing housing and to try to do so in a competitive market for housing, so as to try to attract a renter to say, this is the place that I would want to live over this other place, because they're offering potentially better amenities, lower rent. My concern is that in attempting to regulate that market, we might end up seeing a more rigid structure, which doesn't allow for landlords to kind of compete against each other and ultimately allow the consumers, in this case the renters, to be able to make better choices with a better selection of available renting opportunities. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, Argentina's history with rental control doesn't start in 2020. It actually starts in the 1920s with the first rental control policies that were instituted there. And, you know, even in the 1920s, they were struggling with it. But, you know, it was far more sustainable because of Argentina's much smaller population, right? You didn't have... Buenos Aires was not like a city of 20 million like it is now. You know, and similarly, you know, rental control policies existed across, you know, many countries at that period of time, because it simply made more sense, you know, in terms of like both the labor market and also the housing market. I think here, you know, I'm not a big fan of landlords personally. Mm-hmm. I believe very firmly in the democratization of rental, meaning that tenants should actually have unions, which would then own apartment complexes and help regulate rent, you know, such that the needs of the tenants are provided for by virtue of it being a tenant-owned space. But because we're working with a system in which we have landlords, I think, you know, this question of whether or not... I mean, right now what we are seeing in this housing market is very large companies will essentially become landlords, right? And they have no incentive to compete with other companies because they're not even from here, right? A lot of these groups, like, they have no real stakes in Pittsburgh, right? A lot of the housing developers have no real stake in Pittsburgh. A lot of the apartment owners have no real stake in Pittsburgh. It's just about the production of capital, which, you know, it's not really serving the consumers as much as I would like. And I think imposing, if not rental control, but some way of ensuring that the people who are owning these properties, who are renting these properties, have a vested stake in the community, right? Some sort of imposition like that, I think, should be a minimum, right? Because if you don't have a stake in the community, if you don't see the Pittsburgh community as something that you are a part of and therefore should engage with and provide for, then I really don't think you should be a landlord, because you're only going to put your own tenants and yourself at a disadvantage, because your turnover rate will probably be incredibly high if you're not interested in and invested in the community you're a part of and creating.
Well, firstly, you know, I definitely agree on the premise of trying to encourage community. And, you know, I very firmly believe that you're always going to have a better relationship with, you know, your local mom and pop than you are with, you know, your local Target. But what I will say at the same time is two things. Firstly, you know, any supplier of any good is ultimately going to be beholden to the people who consume from them. And I would say in the case of, you know, like, let's take some large company that's decided to grab some skin in the game in the Pittsburgh rental market. They want to be as attractive as possible to the Pittsburgh rental community in order to attract people to rent from their properties. And that puts them up against other people in this market. And that may be other large actors, maybe two or three, and then a combined medley of, you know, individual rent landlords who have maybe one to three or four properties that they rent. These people, I mean, while you all have larger competitors in there, to my understanding, Pittsburgh is not under. I know Walnut Capital is a very large renter in Pittsburgh, a large landlord in Pittsburgh, but is one of many actors in the Pittsburgh rental market. And what I think is so great about, you know, there's, and something I want to get back to was the conceptualization of kind of union-owned housing communities that you'd brought up. And I kind of want to hear a little bit more about that in a second. But what I think is interesting is, you know, when you have in a ideally free market, when the renters are looking at their options, their ability to allocate their capital to wherever they see is the most worthy of doing so allows them to influence the action of these actors that are trying to provide housing in this case. You know, you want to stick it to these people that are trying to jack your rent up 25% in this one neighborhood. You know, you say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, my good friend Joe in Shadyside is offering me a better going rate. While it may be another 10-minute commute, that the marginal utility that I gain from choosing this over what you're giving me is going to be higher, so I'm going to go that way. And then Walnut Capital could be like, well, no, we want you to stay here. Might prevent them from going through with that. You know, you have across the board things like inflation or economic conditions, which will cause rents across the board to raise, and there's nothing you could really do about that. And in the case in which you institute rent controls, you end up having the negative economic shock of prices not adjusting on all ends, and you end up disadvantaging one player in the equation over the other, and that's when you start to have issues.
Well, you know, what I would say to that is that, like, the players are already, you know, they've had their legs cut at the ankle, right, in a lot of these cases. And I think it's, I mean, we're sitting here at Carnegie Mellon. We're coming to this from an incredibly privileged perspective, right, because we can afford to say, well, I've got a buddy Joe who can provide me a better going rate. But, you know, if you're a black or brown tenant in the city of Pittsburgh, you know, oftentimes your choice is between a rock and a hard place. I mean, and this is how gentrification has occurred across the city, where huge swaths of communities like East Liberty, like The Hill, like others, Highland Park and more, where and Oakland is probably the most egregious example, right, in the city, where the original population is, has been slowly displaced and replaced because of these kind of rental turnover. And where have they been forced to go? They've either been forced to leave the city or they've been forced to move to the suburbs. And this is why Pittsburgh is one of the worst cities in the country for Black Americans to live in. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen those statistics.
I have seen that, yes.
And, you know, that's atrocious, right? Like, I think you and I are both on the same page that, like, a city should be a livable place for everyone, regardless of who you are and what your economic standing may be. You know, there should at least be, you know, the option for you to be safe and comfortable in your own community, right? And so I think, like, when we're talking about the issue of, you know, competition and things like that in the local renters market, we have to have a measure of sensitivity to that reality for those disadvantaged tenants, because, like, you know, if you're a student in Oakland, still many students in Oakland are disadvantaged. I've spoken to so many students at Pitt who are, you know, tenants for Walnut Capital who are like, I can't really find anywhere else, mm-hmm. you know, because if you're trying to be a student in Pittsburgh, living in Oakland is one of your best options.
Yeah.
Public transit, access to food and water, like, you know, there's so much that you're dependent on here
yeah.
in Oakland. So I think, you know, there's more factors than just, like, the market itself in Pittsburgh that
yeah.
we have to be cognizant of.
Well, and I'd extend it to say, and I think this might be an area where we have some agreement, that current zoning in the city of Pittsburgh in a lot of areas works against the ability to develop enough housing to meet the demand. I heard a very interesting – I went to a very interesting talk last week. The gentleman, Nolan Gray, who spoke, talking about zoning and current requirements for minimum parking, kind of things that bar the development of greater supply. And, you know, because, I mean, I know we're coming at this from different angles, and I think that where we find overlap is a wonderful place. And I'm curious, you know, kind of where this would come on your end as well, but kind of coming from the market's perspective of this. You know, anytime you're looking at a raising of prices in a particular market, you're going to say, well, there's obviously demand rising here and the supply is just not meeting it. In a lot of ways, we need to look to build our supply in the city of Pittsburgh for housing. And a large issue with that is the difficulty to develop. It's obviously not as bad as I'm from Suffolk County, New York, and it's terrible, the zoning out that way. You know, especially considering the fact that, you know, so many people are leaving. You know, it's a much more drastic case of what's already happened in Allegheny County. You know, people are leaving because they can't find affordable housing. And a lot of that has to do with a lack of supply driving up the pricing. And we really need to, if we're going to take any serious steps towards trying to have a long-term plan for, you know, how do we address affordability, I would say, you know, we're looking to advise a new incoming, well, not incoming, but now a fresh administration at the county level. How do we address this issue? We should really start by looking at things that we can do at no cost to the taxpayer or to any negative impact on the economy, which comes in the form of zoning reform. And I think that might be a wonderful place to kind of start if we're looking at ways for us to equitably deal with the issue of affordability.
I agree. I absolutely. I think that's it's such an underrated part of local politics is zoning. I think everyone kind of thinks of it as rather boring, but it really is so crucial to every part of the process of urban development and planning. And I think, you know, in our city, like, on the one hand, yes, it's very hard to... there's also an issue of geography, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, on top of that. I mean, I live down in a valley, right? And
yeah.
and not far from where that proposed development was. I don't know if you...
Is it the Mon Valley... not sure exactly.
It was a development that was proposed that was going to be like right in the middle of that chunk of Frick Park.
Vaguely,
right,
vaguely
down
aware
forward.
Of it. I would have to look into it more. But even for the listeners who might not be aware, Just a quick summary.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you're ever driving on Forward and you go down the Forward Hill down towards Swiss Home Park in Swissvale, you know, that whole winding road on the left side, you know, you'll see a Walnut Towers, and then below that, Salford Park, right? And that area, this sort of chunk where the old Irish Center is zoned for parkland, right? Mm-hmm. Like at the moment, you can't build an apartment complex on it. And the intention was to build an apartment complex on it by a Toronto-based firm for luxury condos for, like, basically old people moving out of Squirrel Hill.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's constructed. I mean, the architecture for it was painful to look at, but you know, that aside, you know, it was constructed in such a way that it proved to be more ecologically hazardous and also, like, physically hazardous for its residents.
Gotcha.
Than anything else, because we have some roads in Pittsburgh and some places in Pittsburgh where it's damn near impossible to cross certain roads.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have access to public transit, or if the road is, like, there's not even sidewalks on Forward.
Yeah.
Right? You know, how are you going to expect a bunch of old people from Squirrel Hill to kind of live in this, like, you know, mountainside monastery? They're never going to get out, right? Yeah. And so I think, like, when we're talking about things like zoning reform and development, it has to be done with a lot more discretion in a place like Pittsburgh than it does in somewhere like New York. Like, I'm from upstate, right?
Yeah.
Buffalo's flat. Right? It's like, if you've ever been to Buffalo, New York.
You are listening to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America here on WRCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. Plane headed from Kansas collided with a military helicopter over Washington, D.C. 67 people died.